it off.
Malka.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Mm-hmm.
We can begin. This is first class and of she was muted. Okay. So this is a first class in a couple of weeks. And the question is, do you have any questions from before? Because we have covered, obviously not all of creation, but pretty much all of creation. We started in the endless world. We came down. We looked at the physical world. We looked at that there are other creations in other planets, in other worlds, in other dimensions, depending on your point of view and whatever science develops. And then there is the concept of the flood, the Tower of Babel. Now, there are obviously much more than those specific stories, but in the concept of the flow of history, those are the main points. One emphasis that I probably didn't make in the course of the discussion was our world is the only world where there is one species that has been given free choice. That's human beings. In all other creations, there is not free choice. There are negative worlds, negative entities living on negative worlds, and there are positive entities living on positive entities. Worlds. Nowhere else in the universe is free choice. And I haven't really discussed that at length or emphasized it, but it needs to be as we move forward into human history, as we start to talk about Abraham and what happened with the Tower of Babel. So does anybody have any questions from the earlier classes?
The Tower of Babel, why it started?
Why did people build a Tower of Babel?
Yeah.
There was a king named Nimrod who had charisma in modern terminology. And he wanted to be acknowledged as supreme, not just supreme as a human being, which would be people bowing down to him or whatever he thought, whatever he said, whatever he stated, would his subjects would make happen. But Nimrod wanted to be supreme as in being God, being the divine, being in control of angels, which in his generation, human beings were in control of angels. And even today, we are in control of angels, providing we know their name. And they are given permission to lie to a human being if he asks their name. There's a certain ritual that has to be followed, or they will lie. What is their name? To prevent them being abused by a human being telling them to do something that goes against God's laws. When it comes to the demons, there's no need to hide their name. Why? Because the demon, whatever the human being wants to do on the negative side, the demon is going to support. And this leads to a consciousness of there's a battle between good and evil. But there isn't. And this is part of what we have to understand. Is there a battle between good and evil? Do we think there are?
Oh, yes. I have it within myself.
Joe says there's a battle between good and evil within himself. And that is, many of the sages say that. Many of the sages say there's a Yetzer Hara, an evil inclination, and a Yetzer HaTov, a good inclination. And both inclinations are whispering in our minds, in our ears. And we make a decision between the two. And based on that decision, there are consequences. If we choose to listen to the good inclination, we're going to receive goodness. And if we choose to listen to the evil inclination, we're going to receive chaos. And that is considered the battle between good and evil. Is that a true story? Is that part of human history? Are there good human beings and evil in human beings?
Yes.
I'm sorry to disagree.
I was waiting for that.
There are evil actions. There is no evil human being. Every human being has a soul and a body. Every human being, the soul of every human being, was part of the soul of Adam and Chava. So, was Adam evil?
Evidently, no, but his action was.
Adam himself was perfect, but he wasn't, but he made a mistake. What kind of mistake did he make? God said, don't eat from the tree of knowledge, good and evil. Another way to describe that is God said, don't eat from the tree of death. And Adam did.
As God said, if you do, you will surely die.
Correct.
And I remember fairly recently, 12 years, I guess, in reading that, well, it's not true. Adam ate and didn't die, except later on he did.
And what do you learn from that?
Well, if he hadn't eaten the fruit, he would still be alive.
If he hadn't eaten the fruit, according to the sages, at the end of Shabbat, that first Shabbat, Adam was created on Friday. At the end of that first Shabbat, he would have returned to the endless world, totally corrected. Bread of shame would have been eliminated. But he didn't. And that's where the question is, was his action evil or not? The consequences of his action was death entered the world in a potential energy. Actually, there was always death in a potential energy, but death became manifested. Yes, there was time between Adam eating and Adam dying. That time is the distance between the cause and the effect. What is the purpose of that distance? To do teshuvah. And Adam did teshuvah. But he made other mistakes. God didn't say just don't eat from the tree of life. He said be fruitful and multiply. Adam had two children, and then he separated from Chava, from Eve, because he was angry with her. he blamed her for bringing death into the world. It wasn't my fault, it was hers. God said, what did you do? And he said, she made me do it. This is a human being, right? We're never responsible. We never did it ourselves. The question is, would Adam have not eaten from the tree of life? Excuse me. Could Adam have not eaten from the tree of knowledge, good and evil? Did he have free choice? Well, the answer is, how old is Adam? He's a 20-year-old body, and he's a soul, how many eons old? But did he have free choice? Or was he a child who could not have free choice?
I would argue he was a child because since he didn't have the knowledge from the fruit, the forbidden fruit, he was living a naive life.
Plus, there's even one more issue. You're absolutely right, Joe. Adam and Chava were children. They were in full-grown bodies, in adult bodies, but they were children. What do you have with a full-grown body and a child's mind? A child's soul. He's going to experiment with sexuality, with creativity. He's going to play in the sandbox. He's going to build sandcastles. The other issue Adam doesn't have free choice because he has never experienced the effect of his actions. If I say to you, let me rephrase it, God created the human being with the nature that if someone tells you to do something, your reaction is to not do it. Isn't that true?
It depends on the action, what they tell you to do.
You do what your parents tell you, but you don't like it. What does the 2-year-old say?
No.
No. Why does he say no? The parents are telling him what to do. And he's saying no. This is the nature of the human being, to demand that I will make my own decisions. I will do what I want to do, not what you tell me to do. And if that is the inbuilt nature, there really isn't free choice. Why? Because God has given free choice, therefore he cannot give you, make a demand on you. Because he knows I've given you this innate nature. So if I tell you what to do, you're going to want to not do it. And that takes you away from balance. That takes you away from the consciousness of free choice. In the Torah, we have this phrase, Hashem hardened Pharaoh's heart. And people struggle with that. The sages struggle with that. If God is so good, why is he putting so much damage on Pharaoh? Why is he making him choose, hardening his heart so he will choose to get more damage to his nation? Doesn't make any sense if God is good, does it?
Is he giving him to damage the nation?
To damage the nation. If you're a leader of the nation, of any nation, do you have the responsibility to not create damage in that nation?
told you.
He did it, but he said
he did. He said Moses would go next month. The cycle of the plagues was Moses went to Pharaoh, said, "Let my people go." Pharaoh said no. Moses said, "Here is the plague that is coming." And then the plague would happen not that day, a week later. And that second week of the month, so to speak, the second week of the month, the plague happened.
That was the damage to the nation.
That's the damage to the nation. The third week, the plague leaves, people settle down. The fourth week comes, and they're anticipating Moses' return. Moses returns next month, essentially. The fifth week, "Let my people go." Pharaoh says no. Moses says, "This is the plague that's coming." And the cycle of 4 weeks repeats itself. Why did God harden Pharaoh's heart? Pharaoh was ready to say, "Yes, go ahead, leave." Why did he harden his heart? And what does hardening his heart mean?
It seems like
one question, and then I'll let you answer. My question is, can you define coercion?
Coercion is when someone, person number one says to person number two, "If you don't do what I want, then such and such will happen."
That's not the definition of coercion. That's the example of coercion. I agree with you. And metaphor, we use metaphors all the time to give you definitions. So I can accept that as a definition. But in reality, was Pharaoh given free choice? His nation was destroyed. First, the plague of blood. What did the plague of blood mean? It meant people could not drink water and receive benefit. The plague of frogs, what did it mean? People could not stay away from the cacophony of the sound of the grokking, or whatever the sound they make. What's another? The plague of lice. People were uncomfortable, right? Lice is not a pleasant experience. Just ask every kid who has to have his head shaved and washed with lye to remove the lice from his hair. When you are in pain, you have no free choice. Because the body says, "Whatever relieves my pain, I will do." There's no free choice. Pharaoh's heart being hardened was just as Adam. Pharaoh forgot about the pain of his nation. That's what hardening his heart was. He was hardening his heart to the pain of his people. Since he didn't remember them suffering, Moses walks in the door and says, "Let my people go," and he says, "No." That's his free choice. That's what he wanted to do. If he would still remember the plagues, there would have been no free choice. He would have said, "Anything you want, Moses." Coercion leaves you without free choice. Pain is coercion. Now, how does that apply to Adam? Was Adam in pain? No, he was inquisitive. He wanted to know. But he had this inbuilt nature. God said, don't eat. And that meant he wanted to eat. It wasn't his free choice. It wasn't God said, no, I'll follow his lead. It was saying, God said, no, therefore I want to eat. You can't say no to the taste. You can't say no to the fruit if you want to eat it.
Strong man once told there was a reptile, a snake that was involved.
Well, there's confusion over whether there is a snake or whether there's a satan. There is a reptile. There is a snake, and the snake rode on something. Satan rode on something. So there's this question, but it's essentially we don't really delve into it. But essentially, there is a snake who is the transportation to Satan.
I'm sorry for what it up.
No.
I want to check my memory, see if I made it up.
Absolutely. What did the Midrash says, this is what happened. God told Adam, do not eat from the tree of knowledge, good and evil. Where was Eve? This statement was made after Eve is separated. So there are two human beings. But God is talking to Adam, not to Eve. So where was Eve? The Midrashim indicate she was playing with the snake. But essentially, there was a conversation between husband and wife. Eve, God told me, do not touch the tree of knowledge, good and evil. That wasn't what God told him, is it? He said, do not eat. Adam told Eve, do not touch. Big difference. Along comes the snake another day, another hour, and says, look at that tree. Isn't it beautiful? Absolutely, the tree is beautiful. Why don't you go touch it? Adam told me not to touch it. I'm not going to touch it. Snake says, okay, let's get closer. You don't want to touch it? No problem. Oops, I pushed you into it. Chava, Adam told you not to touch it. You touched it and you didn't die. I guess Adam's a liar.
So, not only should you touch the tree, but touch the tree, I might as well go ahead and eat some of the fruit.
Isn't the tree beautiful? Isn't the fruit beautiful? Why don't you? Plus the fact that in that time, that tree, the bark of the tree tasted like the fruit. So when she touched the bark of the tree, she was tasting the fruit of the tree. And so the snake is saying, look, Adam's a liar. I'm telling you the truth. Here's a beautiful fruit. You see it. You know it. Take a bite. Here, I'm biting one, you bite one. And Chava makes, as a child, makes that decision, and she eats it. And her eyes are opened, whatever that means. Her eyes are opened. She realizes she's naked. What is the metaphor of being naked? Does it mean that she's not wearing a loincloth and her breasts are uncovered? Does it mean sexuality? You think a 3-year-old would perceive it that way? Of course not. What does it mean? My eyes were opened. Her eyes were opened. She was able to see more of the physical and spiritual worlds. She was able to see how the physical mirrored the spiritual. She was able to see what she was not yet ready to see. Have you learned something in your life that you weren't ready to handle? What is PTSD, as the disease is now called? You send a soldier into war, he sees things that are just atrocious, and he comes back with PTSD because he cannot handle what he saw.
Sometimes what he's done.
Same idea. Adam comes to Eve and said, "What's wrong?" And she said, "Here, I ate it. I can see things amazing. You eat it." And Adam says to himself, "This is my wife. She's spiritually higher than me. She says it's okay, I'll do it." But didn't God tell you not to eat it? Didn't you tell her not to touch it?
And that started it all.
But there was no free choice in that decision. That's the point. As a child, they couldn't make the decision. And you don't think God knew that?
So by touching and eating the fruit, they get the knowledge that they weren't ready for.
They got the knowledge they were not ready for.
But if they hadn't touched it and eaten it, at what point would they be ready?
Right after Shabbat. Why? What is Shabbat? It's the unity of the physical world with the spiritual world. The physical world elevates to the level of the spiritual world. They're unified.
That's the second soul.
So they can see. They can handle what they see. They can handle their actions, using your metaphor with PTSD. But they ate before Shabbat. How long before Shabbat? 6 hours. If they'd only waited 6 hours, there would have been no chaos, no pain, no suffering in this world. How come we had to experience it? Why couldn't we wait 6 hours? Why do we want everything now in this generation? One of the edicts of history, remember, history is a veil to conceal God's actions. One of the edicts of history is that what happens to the fathers will happen to the children. How many people marry their mothers? How many women marry their fathers? They're not physically the same human being, but in their personality traits, they are. Is it 100% true? Is it totally accurate? No. That's how we begin to understand what history really is telling us. History repeats itself, but not quite exactly. Why? Because some people made their tikkun. And when they left the world, they don't come back. So if you have 100 people and two of them make their tikkun, and the same 100 people or the same 98 people come back, it's a similar desire to receive as the first 100, but it's slightly different by two people, by two desires. This is history.
What does tikkun mean? Tikkun.
Tikkun is correction. So let us go forward a little bit. We have Abraham. His name is not Abraham. His name is Avram. Avram means elevated father. You think he was named that when he was born? You think that was the name they gave the child? Are children called by the same name they're called later in life? A child is named Deborah, but is called Debbie. A child is named Charles, but is called Charlie. There's a diminutive in Yiddish, Rinala. Rina means beautiful. The La means diminutive, a child. You're a beautiful child. This is human nature. As the child grows, do they change their name?
Sometimes.
I can't say 100% of the time they change their name. So you're right, sometimes. But I would emphasize that it's more likely to happen than not to happen. Why? Because as you grow towards your tikkun, you decide that the name no longer fits you. The teenager who doesn't want to be a little child says, "Don't call me Debbie. My name is Deborah. Or my name is a beautiful, something else that I like. I like that movie star. So I'm going to call myself Meryl." His name was Deborah. So what? I like Meryl Streep, so I'm going to be called Meryl. People change their names. There are some people who do not. I had a principal when I was teaching fifth grade Hebrew school, religious school. I had a principal, Debbie Rowe. She'd been Debbie from the time she was born. Her name was Deborah. She didn't like Deborah. She liked Debbie. Because her name didn't change, the student of Kabbalah and me said and understood there was no tikkun growth. There was no spiritual growth for this woman. Intellectually phenomenal. Taught me more than I will ever remember how to be a good teacher. But spiritually, she entered the world as a teenager, the same level she exited the world, if she has yet. I lost contact with her, so I don't really know.
Changed my name legally. Because I was given the nickname at birth. I was given Joe.
Joe, and you didn't like it?
Well...
Or you did like it, and this is your name.
I was named after my mother's father. His name was Joe, and it was spelled J-O.
And that's not acceptable.
And we're not sure what the history behind that was. It was a relative or friend of the family, though, a woman named Joe.
Right.
Instead of
J-O-E, yeah. It was J-O.
And... plus, he had no middle name, and I was not given a middle name.
Me either.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a C
social security card that said Joe, parentheses, MMM.
Right, no middle name.
No middle name. Well, back in the 50s.
That was the technique.
Well,
birth certificates were written that way.
Oh, yeah. But I could also, I didn't have to go to court to, like, take a middle name. So when I opened a savings account or somewhere along the line, I started using my mother's birth name, so Joe Kennedy Chancy.
Mm-hmm. Probably around 1960 when the Kennedys became public property.
Let's see. I think it was before that. So it's been 12.
12 would have been the 60s when he died.
Yeah.
Aaron Wiggins, could you please call the operator?
I'm like, Aaron, call the operator. I found out that you could fill out a form the size of this page
mm-hmm.
when you got your new driver's license and legally change your name. So I changed it to Joseph. Kennedy Chancy.
Do you know the history of Joseph Kennedy?
He's a bootlegger, is what I've heard.
It's where the money came from, bootlegging. Yeah. The reason I say that is in Judaism, we are cautioned to name a baby after the biblical characters, and the biblical characters after Abraham, not before Abraham. The biblical character, not the family member. Why? Because the name relates to the tikkun. A family member, if they're still living, which is the Sephardic custom, they will name children after the still living parents or relative. But if the family member isn't living, what did they die from? They died from heart disease. They died from cancer. They died from an accident. They died from this, that, or the other thing. What you're doing when you name the child with that name is transferring the tikkun to the child, because the names are the same. The tikkunim is the same. Doesn't mean that the tikkuns are exact, because history repeats itself, but not exactly. But it means there's a possibility that if that person died of cancer, that the child will get cancer. There's a possibility that if they have heart disease, the child will get heart disease. Now, scientifically, the genes could be similar. But the issue is to be conscious of it. So you don't name a child after a relative, you name the child after the biblical character. The biblical character is righteous. You don't name somebody Job. You don't name somebody Pharaoh. You don't name somebody Nimrod. You name them after positive biblical characters. These are tzaddikim. You're giving the child the opportunity to be a tzaddik. Does it matter what your consciousness is when you give the child the name?
Oh.
It certainly does. If you're thinking of great Aunt Ethel, who died from cancer, and you're naming the child Ethel, you're connecting the disease to the child, God forbid.
Well, Aunt Ethel was a wonderful person.
Of course she's a wonderful person. We would never name her a newborn baby after somebody who's not a wonderful person. But I have to ask you, have you ever been to a funeral where the person was not wonderful? Died?
That's crossed my mind a number of times.
We are taught to judge leniency after death, because after all, they're in heaven, and they're there to help us. So we don't want them to be angry with us by talking bad about them. My children once said to me, "Why don't you ever talk about your parents? I don't know anything about your parents. I know my other grandparents. They were living. I interacted with them. My mother loved her father, loved her mother. There was constant interaction. Why don't you talk about your parents?" My answer was, "You've never asked." Do I have a close relationship with my mother? Not as a child. She was a wonderful woman. But she was a Scorpio sun sign, and I was a Sagittarius sun sign. And fire and water makes great steam until the water puts the fire out. So my childhood technique of survival was to stay away. I was born asthmatic. I was put into an oxygen crib for 11 months. And then my mother said, "You're going to live a normal life or you're not going to live at all." Was she trying to kill me? That's what a child heard. It's not true. She didn't mean it. But I was 32 years old and in her last year of life before we resolved that, before I came to understand her meaning. I'm going to speak to my children because when I was 32, my youngest child was 3, my oldest was 8. They'd already been formed. They'd already got this idea of the relationship between my mother and myself. They saw, they were interacting with me when I helped my mother through her last 2 years during her cancer. So they saw I took care of her, but they also knew there was no real love between us prior to that. This is my process, my tikkun. And we did heal. And I recommend that everybody heal. But would I have healed if I didn't understand anything I've just said to you until I was 45 when I started to study Kabbalah? But yet the healing took place before that. So when my daughter said to me, "Why don't you tell us about your parents?" And I said to them, "Why don't you ask a question?" To this day, they haven't asked a question. They don't want to know. I don't know the reason why. One day it will be revealed. I hope my stories are not causing you, any of you, pain.
No, from that story, I was just thinking about when my mother died, or at 99,
mm-hmm.
and I'm the youngest, my sister, the oldest, and when we visit, sometimes we'll talk about her. And there's so many things I've learned about her from my sister that stories I enjoy, things I just find fascinating.
But did you ever ask her to speak about other events that she hasn't spoken to you about? And I'm not asking you to do that. I'm just raising the question.
Well, I have to know what event to ask about.
No, you don't. You could say, you've told me these wonderful stories. Are there any more? But you don't feel the need. You don't have a lack, so you don't ask the question. That's why my children have not asked the question, even though I've said to them repeatedly, if you want to know about my family, let's videotape and you ask questions. Never happened.
Yeah, we'll have, when they get older, when your children, then they'll want to know.
Well, then they'll be able to still ask me because I'm going to be here for another at least 300 years. And so they'll
just
be able to ask.
You don't, you're busy with your own life. You don't.
Correct. You don't have time to do it. You're absolutely correct. You know, this is a cycle of life.
Later on, you should have asked questions.
Correct.
It was some years after I changed my name that I got thinking, I wonder if I hurt my mother's feelings by doing that because she had named me. And I didn't ask her if she was still alive. Then it was sometime after that I was like, oh, wait a minute, my mother hated her name. She changed it. Where my change was sort of an extension of what she did.
Correct. We need to understand spiritually, whoever names the child, at that moment of naming, they are given the insight into what name is appropriate and the best name for the tikkun of that child. This is what Judaism teaches. Every strain of Judaism, every community teaches the same idea. Whoever names the child is doing so because that's what they're given, Ruach HaKodesh, Holy Spirit. They're given a level of consciousness for that moment that they match the name to the tikkun of the child. Now.
But they don't usually go that deep.
You know, new parents and even parents with other children, they'll spend months looking up names in books of names. They'll have chosen a boy's name and a girl's name. They'll have chosen as three or four for each. And then they name it something totally different they never considered.
I know, and you ask them if you name it after a relative who has passed on.
Right. That's when...
Do it after
relatives who are still living.
I like that. There.
Mm-hmm.
So you really, I know you have no choices. It has to be somebody who's passed on.
For the Ashkenazi, they have to have passed on. But for the Sephardi, their custom is anybody, whether they passed or whether they're still living. And the idea behind why it's still living is because they didn't die of cancer. They didn't die. We're not connecting them to this disease that kills the person.
But you don't think about what caused their death.
No, you're thinking about what kind of a wonderful person they are. But that's why we're taught.
It's required to give that, I guess, the spirit to live on.
Yes.
Am I making sense?
You're absolutely making sense. It is part of the consciousness of continuity. That soul is still coming, and perhaps the reason you're naming it after that person, that relative, is because that is a reincarnation of that relative. Frequently, grandparents, when they die, will reincarnate as the children of their children, the grandchildren. Mostly it's great-grandchildren, but it's all part of the process. Reincarnation can happen immediately. If you've studied Torah, when you die, you may not go to hell. You're protected from going to Gehinnom, from hell. You will reincarnate immediately. Or you'll sit in a purgatory concept until it's time for you to come to the world and reincarnate. But that purgatory in our generations are not long periods. They're very quick. because we only have 220 years left to go. That's not until the world gets destroyed. It's until this cycle of 7,000 years is completed. All of this we have talked about in the earlier classes.
What happens at the end of this cycle of 7,000 years?
Yes. What happens? There are some of the sages teach there are 7,000-year cycles. We are in the second of those 7,000 years, and that's why the Torah begins with the letter Bet. It's one of the 70 explanations why the letter is a Bet and not an Aleph. Other explanations are that there will be 1,000 years of peace leading to the 7,000 year, and there will be nothing after that because Moses took out the Erev Rav when he made the redemption from Egypt. And because the Erev Rav, the meaning of that term is large evening, large darkness. When Adam separated from Chava for 130 years, he was in the inner earth. He wasn't living on this earth. He was living in the inner earth, different dimensions. And he was cohabitating, but not in the traditional sense. He was cohabitating with the negative aspect, the female form of Satan. And she was using his sperm to create souls. And when those souls would incarnate into the world, they were not Jewish. They were not children of Israel. But they were all living in Egypt, and they all saw the miracles and the plagues and how wonderful Hashem is. They said, I want to be Jewish. This is the way to go. And they went to Moses, and they said, we want to convert. Moses went to God and said, can I convert them? And God said, it's not recommended. He didn't say no. He said, it's not recommended. Moses said, okay, they can come with me. And over the 40 years in the desert, they converted. But did they convert for the proper reasons? The answer is no. And so we have today, according to the Zohar, the rabbis of this generation, this final generation, the souls of the Erev Rav have reincarnated and chosen to be rabbis. Why? Because they can be honored if they're a rabbi. Why did they convert to Judaism? Because they saw it was the right path. They saw it was the path that could defeat Egypt. They saw it was the path that where all the gold and silver is. They saw it was the path that would lead them to the physical riches. Or maybe they saw that this was the right spiritual path for them. Who is to know what someone's reason for converting is? I know your reason, Joe, is correct. I trust that.
I have trouble explaining why. When people would ask me why, it used to be really irritating. Then I realized if I explained how.
But that's because people are not asking you why. You explain the how and it satisfies them. But you have to know for yourself the why. And if it's still hard to explain, you have to delve into that. I'm not asking you to explain it. I'm explaining what is tikkun. Tikkun is for Ruth, the Moabitess. For her, the path was to take to convert, because she had a tikkun with Naomi. What was her tikkun with Naomi? She was a daughter-in-law, but she was also a princess in Moab. And she left being a princess to become a pauper.
How many years approximately from Abraham's generation?
6 generations. First 10 generations is from Adam to Noah. From Noah to Abraham is another 10 generations, total 20. From Abraham to Moses is 6 generations. 26 generations from the beginning of this physical world. But at what about the first 7,000-year cycle? The sages tell us there are 974 generations. If you add 26 to 974, you have 1,000 generations.
Abraham was the first Hebrew?
Abraham was the first Hebrew, but what does that mean? The Hebrew word is Ivri. Its translation is Hebrew. Ivri means to cross over. What did Abraham cross over? He crossed over the Tigris, the Euphrates, the rivers. But what he really crossed over is he left the physical and united with the spiritual. And that's the true meaning of an Ivri.
Someone who crosses over.
Someone who crosses over. When you converted, you crossed over. When I left Los Angeles and I ended up in Atlanta, did I cross over? Or did I just move? I'm on the same level, but I just moved. Both can be true.
Mississippi River.
Twice. I crossed over to I got as far as Mississippi, and my daughter calls and said, I'm pregnant. I need you to come help me when the baby is born. Will you do so? So, of course, I said yes. And I crossed back over the Mississippi to get all the way to California in 2 days or 3 days. I watched the Brit Milah that I was sure my daughter was not going to have. Because she, for 8 months, she's saying she's not going to have it. But my daughter, my other daughter, who is the educator in Temple Sinai, is working on her for 8 months that she should do this. So I watched the Brit Milah because they had to do it before I could get there. And, you know, 2 days later, so on the 10th day of my grandson's life, I arrive in San Francisco, and I'm there for 9 months. And when he can crawl faster than I can walk, it's time to leave. It was a good, wonderful period. It's a very special period for me, you know. He doesn't remember any of it, of course. I believe we're out of time. And I hope you consider this a history class. But it really was based on the question that you asked, which was an excellent question.
What?
the one about... The Tower of Babel. Does anybody have any questions on the conference call?
Nimrod wanted to be.
He wanted to be God.
So God didn't like that. That's why
No. God doesn't care. God does not care. This is an important, very important concept. God does not care.
It crumbled.
If God cared, then somebody who kills another human being would be struck dead. He would live a horrible life and die. Doesn't happen.
Why did the Tower of Babel crumble? It crumbled.
Didn't crumble.
It never got built.
It got built. It never crumbled.
What happened to it?
The people were transformed. God creates the world every instant. So one instant the tower was built, the next instant the people no longer spoke one language. They now spoke 70 languages. The tower that was built is not built then. It's gone. God doesn't have to create me at the same as I was last instant. He can create me with thoughts and the memories. Are those the memories I had in the last instant, or are they different? How much do you trust Hashem? And does it matter? If he creates you with different memories, does it really matter?
I thought you were going to say, does it matter what you...
The answer is, does it matter with what you remember? Is that important? Why?
To guide you, through life.
Are you looking to the future or are you looking to the past? What is the purpose of your memories?
Guide
the future.
Future.
Not to make the same mistakes.
Right, the past is gone.
So does it matter if he changes your memories? Because you've learned those lessons. You don't need those memories to learn about the future.
Not to make the same error.
Exactly.
Make a different one.
But also, people find what I've just said very uncomfortable. And if you do so, let's talk about it, because it can be very uncomfortable to think that God is... that I'm not the same person that I was a minute before. Any questions on the conference call?
No questions, but I really enjoyed it. I came in late, almost 1:20, but I really enjoyed it.
Glad to know that. Thank you, Tana. And I'm glad to have heard about Tony. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
No questions, but it was good.
Thank you, Brandy. Two more classes tonight. Go ahead.
Well, if you have time, I could tell them real quickly. My given name was Barbara, and it meant stranger, foreigner. And my maiden name was Hebert, spelled H-E-B-E-R-T, which would be Eber with a T, which is feminine. That means she crossed over. And that's exactly what I did. My name was prophetic.
All names are prophetic. People just don't know that because they don't study their names. And Hannah's case, it's very true. She also converted. She did and I apologize if that was, I know that's not embarrassing to you, Hannah, but it's not appropriate for me to say.
No, but
so I apologize.
But that's okay. It doesn't bother me at all.
Understand. But that's, my students are very interested. Let's put it that way.
Yes, we are.
So as I was saying, two classes tonight, one at 4:30 West Coast time, will be a deep Zohar class, and we are studying the essays on circumcision. And our 7 o'clock class tonight is, I do a weekly general questions and answers question. You know, it's just bring whatever questions on any subject you want, and then I make up the answers, so you don't have to worry. You all have a beautiful afternoon, and Chag Sameach.
Chag Sameach.
Chag Sameach.
Thank you.